We might be talking about this movie, but eventually we're leaving here on VG Please, a heinous trip at Warp 5. My name is Joseph.
And for now, I still have my eyeballs. I'm your co-host, Peter.
Peter, this is a special episode that is going out to our patrons. And that means we're doing something special. We're doing something different. And we're reviewing a film. And it's spooky season. It's actually on time. Here we are at the very end of September. So we have a spooky movie. What did we decide to watch?
Unlike our plans to get Reanimator out for
We got
Halloween.
Out for Easter, which was actually also appropriate. Okay.
I thought it was Christmas.
It's Easter. It was Easter.
Well, there was Reanimation there.
Exactly.
Thematically, there's
a resurrection.
Yeah. We're watching the 1997 Paul Anderson cult classic Event Horizon.
This is one of my favorite movies. So you've seen
this before, right?
Oh, absolutely. I was really excited to review this with you because I knew I was going to be able to watch it with my wife, who also loves Event Horizon. It's one of her favorite movies.
Well, then.
And we spent 3 hours watching it because we paused it to talk about it the entire time. And it was just an absolute joy to go back through with a critical lens.
I watched this over the course of 2 days because I sat down to watch it and my wife was hanging out there kind of haphazardly watching it. And then right when literally all hell is about to start breaking loose, my middle daughter came down and would not leave the room and decided she wanted to fall asleep on the couch while looking right at the TV. And I was like, well, this could be a learning lesson.
This could be an experience
about why when daddy says the movie's scary, look the other way. And I was prepared to just watch it with the mute on and just read the subtitles, but she's just looking at the screen and I'm like, do I teach her a lesson or do I let this moment teach me a lesson when I deal with nightmares for the next 3 weeks? So I opted just to turn it off. I love this movie.
Absolutely.
This came out when I was still working at Regal Cinemas, Mayfield Heights 10, as a usher slash, I don't know, we did a little movie theater business. If you're a good employee, they always stick you behind the concession stand. So sometimes you got to become a bad employee to be able to get back out in the field and clean up dirty auditoriums. But I had the Mylar poster, the actual movie theater issued double-sided poster that they would hang up in the light boxes outside the theater to like advertise things. Infinite space, infinite terror.
First and foremost, they stick you behind the concessions counter because that's the moneymaker.
Absolutely.
So if you're the good employee, that's where you got to be.
They used to put the bad employees in the box office. That way the box office lines would be bad, but then they'd get in and the concession line would be quick because if your concession line got too long, the people wouldn't buy fucking $65 popcorn.
But they'll stick it out to buy their movie ticket. That's why they came. My favorite thing to do was to hang out, of course, in the projection booth, because that's how you get to see all your movies for free as much as possible.
Union projectionists are creepy. I befriended one. As an adult thinking back, I don't know if I would have advised 16-year-old me differently on the subject. But he certainly ignited a passion in me of pirating movies, so thank you, Dave, for your tutelage on how to stick it to the man.
Our projectionist was deaf and just very nice, and he just was happy that people wanted to just be in his presence.
Yeah, there was also some of that, too.
Yeah. You
know. Listen, enough about this fucking movie theater talk, man. Like, I want to talk about this goddamn movie.
Yeah. I don't. Some people actually bag on this. Red Letter Media did a very negative review of this. And madness. There are a few parts of this that are hokey and a little ahead of its time and therefore didn't quite work. But the bulk of this film, from the lore, the understated lore going on about the universe and the way technology works within it, the acting, the performances in this are absolutely a level above what you would expect, given that it's a relatively cheap sci-fi horror movie by a then unknown director.
Now, let's talk about the director real quick. All right, Paul Anderson is not a nobody. 95, dude did Mortal Kombat.
But that's basically it. He did Mortal Kombat.
That's all you need, man. Mortal Kombat was a fucking huge hit. And if there's anything that Paul Anderson, Paul W.S. Anderson is going to go down for, it's being heavy on the gore and not afraid to ride a video game franchise into the fucking dirt, right?
I don't accept the idea that because he directed one good movie, this was a guy who is super well known.
Not super well known, but this is a guy that clearly the studio had some not respect, but certainly some confidence in. And it's hard to look back on these 90s movies and look at the cast, because I'd see the cast as the bodies of work they're sitting on today, not necessarily where they were at in 1997. Sam Neill, Dr. Alan Grant.
Yeah, he needed no career help. Like, he was definitely a get for this kind of movie.
Yeah, but like, the dude's got fucking solid ass wins. Hunt for Red October predated this as well, right?
Correct.
So between like Hunt for Red October, Jurassic Park, I'm curious why he agreed to the role, if it was just bags and bags of money, or maybe he was afraid of being typecast as Alan Grant and that like being a Star Trek moment for him.
I mean, this dude works. He's in a ton of movies. Just looking through his kind of most, gosh, well, let's take a look at what he did through the 90s. Jurassic Park, The Jungle Book, In the Mouth of Madness, Children of the Revolution, Event Horizon. After that, Bicentennial Man, a Jurassic Park sequel, did a movie called The Zookeeper, he got an award for. I mean, it just like every year he's got like two or three movies that have come out. He just does a lot. This man just works.
Sure. And I can't say any of those are solid duds. Well, I don't know.
Some of these are definitely Jurassic Park 3. Movies I've never heard of, but I've never seen Sam Neill in a movie where I felt like he didn't perform well. You know what I mean?
Well, that's a separate story, you know? And if there's one thing that Star Trek Voyager has taught me, it's that you can have people do a great job in their scenes and just be a shit script to run it into the ground. You know, looking around the rest of the cast, you got Lawrence Fishburne. Gosh, where is this at in his...
Well, it's definitely pre-Matrix, which was 99. So yeah, he was obviously in Apocalypse Now, which was like in 1979.
Jason Isaacs is going to be our Star Trek connection here. Old Captain Lorca.
Julie Richardson, who I think is probably most famous for being in The Patriot.
Or is it The Tudors?
Yeah, she's in like the fourth season of The Tudors, though, and she's the main female lead of The Patriot, so I'm going to give her The Patriot.
Jason Isaacs, no, he wasn't. Was he
in it? Yeah, he was Colonel McNazi Man. He was the bad guy in that.
Sean Pertree, who had come on to become Pennyworth in the good seasons of Gotham before it became absolute garbage. Jack Noseworthy is a favorite of mine because I always remember him as the lead character from Dead at 21, which was a MTV original about a group of children that had computer chips in their brains and they were like super smart, but they all die when they turn 21.
Oh, damn. I didn't know anything. This is all new information to me. I did not know this was a guy in a thing like that. That's amazing.
Very unique face. And he always sticks out in my mind. So it's a fun cast with some legit ass talent in it. Paul Anderson, again, I think it's very clear this dude's a nerd and has a way about him that lends itself to sci-fi gore. Mortal Kombat, Event Horizon. Soldier would come out in 98, which was kind of a flop. But again, I was working at the movie theater. I saw it for free. I enjoyed it for what it was. I was just talking about Soldier with some friends.
It's supposed to be a sequel of In the World of Blade Runner, I believe.
Yeah, man. How fucking wild is that? And then we get into Resident Evil, which I think gets up to, what, six sequels? I stand by Resident Evil 1 as a great movie, and it sharply declines after that to the point where watching them back-to-back consecutively, as I have done, leaves you feeling physically ill and disappointed in yourself.
I am sorry to say that Paul W.S. Anderson's career basically enters into a free fall the moment after he shoots Resident Evil 1. His best movies are definitely Mortal Kombat, Event Horizon, Soldier, and Resident Evil, and everything after that is just real bad.
Aliens vs. Predator was, of course, a massive disappointment.
And then all of these sequels, sometimes he directed them, sometimes he just wrote them. And then in between that, he did like a 2008 reboot of Death Race. Blah.
And yeah, then who asked for that?
He did a movie about Pompeii, 2014. I did not know that existed. I can't imagine anyone else watched that. Box office. Oh, well, it made $117 million. I guess some people watch this. Written Kit Harington in it back when like he was super hot off of Game of Thrones. That's Oof. What's up there. The guy we who played Jon Snow.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, I don't know.
I thought maybe for a moment you actually had forgotten about Game of Thrones. I needed to remind you.
I would have liked to. However, I've heard House of the Dragon bantered about so much recently as they've discussed the massive flops coming out of Disney and Disney spending House of Dragons level money on Ahsoka and some of these other series that are just falling flat on their face. This is written by Philip Eisner, who I can't tell you anything else that he has done that pops out at me as familiar other than Event Horizon, Firestarter 2 Rekindled, Mutant Chronicles, and Sweet Girl.
So, okay, I guess.
So here's the plot of Event Horizon if you haven't watched it. In the year, I don't know.
2047.
So there's a little bit of colonization. I forget what they said. The first permanent lunar colony was like established, what, 2023 or something?
2015. We're a little behind.
We're a little behind.
Yeah.
Blame it on the Romulans, all right?
It's confusing the timelines.
In 2047, well, actually, what's 2040?
Correct. 2040 is when the ship disappeared.
So in 2040, a ship named Event Horizon is launched on its maiden voyage to become Earth's first deep space exploration vessel. And during the initial maiden voyage, it is lost with all hands on board. And that's that. And then in 2047, we pick up and we are introduced to a crew of a search and rescue vessel called the Lewis and Clark. They're going to be on a mission as they will come to find out that the Event Horizon has been located off the decaying orbit of Neptune.
Correct.
And that they are going to be bringing the ship's designer out as a subject material expert to attempt to ascertain what happened to the ship and bring it back to Earth.
You mentioned the nerd in Paul W.S. Anderson, and I think that the details in this movie is really what sells it. There's a whole world here that you're constructing with your premise. You're in the near future, so you need to reflect that there's technology that permits space travel within the solar system with relative frequency. You can get to Neptune, and you do so within, I think they said, like 58 days using technology at hand. You have a space exploration and work function that's probably paramilitaristic, if not directly militaristic. And you've got to start designing what your technology looks like. What does space habitation look like? You know, what's the vibe we're going for with these ships? You know, and all of that is so well designed in this movie. It adds tremendously to the experience of watching it. And that's present basically from the beginning.
It is so visually engaging. And if you like the big sci-fi dystopian gritty stuff, you're going to see exactly where this movie fits in. And I would say that this would work perfectly in any number of dirty space movies. This isn't Star Trek by any stretch of the imagination. There's no swoopy lines. There's no post-scarcity society. There's no love for mankind and the best of intentions.
If anything, the crew of the Event Horizon before they activated the engine was the most Star Trek-y you see this movie try to be. Where the captain's like, we're going to turn on the engine and I'm going to say some Latin, you know, like, let's go boldly into the future.
That's a good point, Joe. Yeah, the actual crew of the Event Horizon seemed like they were some pretty positive nerds.
Yeah.
Everything you're presented with as far as Earth and as far as the Lewis and Clark, though, I would say is, I don't want to say a direct rip, but it is certainly highly invoking of the Aliens franchise.
Yeah, they definitely decided that that was the vibe they were going to go for. Not exact, but that sort of analogness is analogness, very important.
The crew is wearing zip-up jumpsuits. Things aren't dirty, but it's cluttered and it feels very lived in. The everything opens with Sam Neill, who we'll find out as Dr. Weir, the designer of the Event Horizon, waking up in this claustrophobic little apartment that's very white and prefab looking. And as he eats his cereal out of a little
in a space station, to be clear,
out of a peel top, whatever, pans out of the window, and you see he's in a capsule in this large scaffolding style space station rotating in orbit above Earth, which apparently they spent a third of their special effects budgets just on that CG there alone. And this is a very interesting movie in terms of like, what is a practical effect? What is a model? And what is CG? Because certainly we get into like a lot of zero G stuff where they're like swiping engine oil and grease and like these 3D globbies all over the place. But like, I wouldn't be surprised if the Event Horizon itself wasn't a model.
Well, I think it was. I think the Event Horizon and the Lewis and Clark were models because they looked so much better than the very primitive CG that this movie is unfortunately stuck with. Some of the things that don't work. The CG, the opening credits is very cringe. The music is very generic.
No way, dude. Orbital? I don't know, man. I must have listened to the fucking Event Horizon intro. I was on my MP3 player frequently. And then, yeah, Prodigy as the closer.
I'm sorry, it doesn't work. It doesn't work for the movie you've made. It was a mismatch. It was a clear tonal mismatch.
You might be right in certain respects, but I think overall you're radically wrong.
It's like the theme of our podcast. You might be right in some ways, but overall you're radically wrong.
Yeah. Empirically, you are absolutely fucking wrong.
Something Stevie pointed out right away in this opening scene is in when Ware goes to shave, he stops when he has his straight razor right at his neck and clearly like contemplates it for a clear second before choosing to continue shaving. It's such a tight moment to put into your movie to communicate something very clearly to the audience without drawing too much attention to it.
That was, so you're taking that scene to be invocative of Weir wants to kill himself.
He clearly has suicidal ideations. Yes.
He's
a man who's obviously experienced loss and he's feeling pain.
Well, certainly. So during the opening scene, he is still obsessing over his deceased wife. There's physical pictures all over the place. And, you know, he's talking, I miss you, Clara, this and that. When he was shaving his, his daily shave and he had the blade, of course, classic horror movie, straight razor, right? No safety razors, no electric razors in space. We just got the old butcher of... Gangs of New York fucking straight razor there. I took it to mean that, his wife who would go on to murder or I'm sorry, to commit suicide with a razor like that. He was thinking of her and the blade to the skin was
the more position of the blade right at his throat at like throat slashing position, I think was not an accident. Where he's like, I could do the same thing my wife did, and then all of this would be over. You know? That's the thought.
So it's a very close world to what we live in, minus the fact that there's not invasive internet and a lot of stuff. And I think that's, again, very Aliens. The technology is there, but it's what if Earth had developed without all of the brain resources going into developing software, web 2.0 and all that other stuff. And
what if it built hardware instead? Yeah.
Yes. Right. So green screen command prompts, very basic graphic user interfaces. Very again, Aliens, right? People smoking on ships. this dirty aesthetic. I don't want to go scene by scene with the movie. I want to kind of like discuss the bigger pictures on things. Everything that you see in terms of like practical sets, technology, all that other stuff kind of goes out the window when they bring the Event Horizon into focus. And as I'm watching it, you know, they berth, they dock, they go to open the outer airlock, and it's a series of gears. Yeah. And there's this running theme with the Event Horizon that just everything about this thing looks dangerous and like it's designed to cut a finger off or somehow maim and mutilate. And I even put in my notes, and they call it out later when they're going through between the containment locks, between like the personnel corridor into the engineering section. And there's this big rotating tunnel, which is
looks like a meat grinder. Yeah.
And that's what I thought when I was watching them open the doors, like, this is a meat grinder ship. Like, this thing looks like it came out of a Tool video and it will fuck you up.
I think there's so much. Well, I know we don't want to go through it scene by scene, but the time you spend on Lewis and Clark as it gets ready to get out there and then go through the process of like pointing the ship in the right direction and powering the engine. And then they got to get into their lockdown pod so they don't get, you know, squeezed by the gravity.
The gravity shift. Pouch is what that's called.
To prevent, because you're going so fast relative to the speed of light that if you're not in this specialized tube, those of you
who don't know, Joe is the one person that enjoys sci-fi that does not enjoy The Expanse. So listening to him sit there and gush over this stuff when it is central concepts to The Expanse,
yes,
is very, what's the word I'm looking for? Hypocritical. Yes.
I try. It's not that I didn't try The Expanse. Sure, I did. I did.
It's grounded in reality, like right? And yeah. And this is all central to the story that we're telling here. Is that fast travel or long distance travel in this universe is deliberate. It's difficult. It's painful, if not flat out deadly. You got to get a shot in your neck. You got to go in this claustrophobic pod. They're going to fill it up with water. Again, very aliens, right? Mm-hmm. They're not in suspended animation. But there's a gross process around it. And yeah, if you're not in the fucking pod, you get turned into paste. So the idea, as we will find out, the Event Horizon was not a deep space exploration vessel, but in fact, a prototype. What do they call them in Star Trek? The Pathfinder vessel? Is that what the first one is?
A Pathfinder vessel. This is Warhammer 40K of warp travel without a Geller field.
That's going to be a whole fucking thing.
Okay. that's what I think the favored sort of like this is a Warhammer prequel.
Well, let's just talk about it right now. And that there's two films here, and one is a fun horror movie, and the other is Welcome to the World of Warhammer, because exactly what you just said. Event Horizon is a prototype vessel that is man's first attempt to move faster than light. Only they're not creating warp drives that allow you to move faster than the speed of light. Event Horizon, which has a black hole powered engine, the Romulans, is able to fold space and merge two points in time and space on top of each other. And once it deactivates the drive, be in a different place. However, Dr. Weir, when he's briefing people on this, fails to mention that moving through this singularity isn't just staying within this dimension, but you are crossing through dimension X. Spoiler alert, it's hell.
So you get to know this crew, you get to see they're very paramilitaristic at a minimum. They're very task oriented. Lawrence Fishburne immediately starts to shine as an excellent like captain. Like, I'm a problem solver. I know to command these people. You have no doubt in your mind after your first scene with him that this is a dude who is 100% in command of both himself and these people, which is very important. And after you go through that and you get this flavor for their technology and these characters, you basically have the round table. Right, where they're discussing the issue. The best part of where talking about it is they react in a way of like, this is bullshit. You're telling me a fantasy. It's like you're telling a bunch of people the Titanic didn't sink. It's actually still out there. And it wasn't an ocean liner. It was a laboratory to build nuclear weapons.
It's the Philadelphia experiment.
Yeah, that's what they're being told. And they respond like you're fucking joking, right? Like, no way. You can't travel faster than light. That's impossible. Like, what is this bullshit? We're out at Neptune. We're not supposed to be out this far.
So, speaking to the crew itself, and let's run through who's who, right?
Right.
Captain Miller, that's Lawrence Fishburne, and he's, the ideal leader. Peters is this lady. She's a med tech.
She's the mama bear.
You've got Jolie Richardson as Stark, who, according to cut footage, had a previous romantic history with Miller, which does not get disclosed in the actual end cut. She's a pretty by the books and for all intents and purposes, the attractive lady. Richard T. Jones is Cooper. And this is your super jock.
Fan favorite.
He's from the streets. He's got a lot of flavor.
This is the man you're rooting for the whole movie. And the movie actually delivers on not killing him, which is probably one of its bigger assets.
Yeah. Jack Noseworthy is Justin, which is terrible. Can't use a first name as a last name, man. Not like I've never met anybody whose last name was Justin. And he's an engineer who is basically the lovable guy that gets fucked. You got Captain Lorca, Jason Isaacs, as the quintessential troubled doctor. You got Alfred Pennyworth, Sean Pertwee as Smith, which is the pilot. And then Holly Chant Claire. Oh, that's his dead girlfriend.
Yeah, the rest of these characters don't really matter. So
what you need to know about these guys is they do not want to be here. And they have just come off a very long mission. They're in the middle of returning to Earth to go into some well-deserved vacation, rest, and relaxation time. And as they are coming back in, the powers that be have immediately snatched them and saying, you're turning right back around. We are putting a stranger on the ship. You are not getting any details as to what's happening. And you are going out to the middle of fucking nowhere, orbit of
Neptune
to do God knows what. And as they will later disclose, this is the furthest out that any rescue attempt has ever been made. And the last time they tried to do something even close to this range away from Earth, both vessels were lost. So these guys wanted a fucking vacation, and instead they're being put on the most dangerous missions of their life for completely unknown reasons. And Miller's reaction to Weir, because Weir tries to like bro him up and like give him a little bit of corporate, what was his
razzle
name?
Razzle dazzle.
Tries to burk him up a little bit.
Okay, yeah.
Miller just shuts him down instantly. And again, there's so much aliens in this, and it's the right way of copying. Like conceptually it's kind of there, but there's enough changes that it's a different story. It's fresh. There is so much cut content. I'm sure you read the wiki on this.
I mean, that's one of the more legendary things about the film, is that it was unsuccessful at the box office, absolutely crushed on DVD because it was an early DVD release. Studio realized that, and they wanted to do director's cut and throw all the extras onto the DVD and make it a big deal and do another release, but then found out the hard way that this was unfortunately a victim of poor film preservation practices. And all of the extra footage, all of the bits and pieces that could have gone into a director's cut was long gone.
There is the romance subplot's gone. There's torture porn, extended torture porn that's gone.
Apparently tons and tons of torture porn.
Which, that'll be a whole section we get into. The stuff I would really like to see is the shadowy organizations that commissioned the Event Horizon.
Ooh, yes.
Discussing, like, what the plan is with Weir and going into, like, details and, like, shadowy corporation shit. I would have loved to have some of that. All sorts of fantastic stuff.
This movie is so well realized, you just want more of it. You want more of its world. You want more of things happening in it. You want to see the consequences of all of this. Like, it just begs for it.
The DVD thing we just talked about this when we were doing some of the YouTube clips about like how Hollywood is off rails and how streaming's a fucking dog and that mm-hmm. people are paying the iron price. You know, once upon a time, you'd put a movie out. This is the 90s, by the way. This is the once upon a time. Once upon a time in the 90s, you'd have the theatrical run, which you could make bank on. Mm-hmm. And now you've got this movie product you've already paid for. And it does its thing, which is go to the theater, and now it's done. And everything past that is gravy. Goes to the movie theater, you make the money there. Then you shop it around as video on demand. Okay, so the different pay-per-view sites or whatever the fuck the hotels do where you're like, you know, renting a movie through that. And then you talk about marketing it through HBO and the cable networks, or, you know, it's getting its chance to run on regular broadcast, which I can only imagine what this would be an easy one, I think. A lot of stuff would get cut towards the end, but a lot of this movie is pretty tame. You know,
it's a haunted house. PG-13, that's probably easier than I'm thinking, yeah.
So you're making money off of that, and then you put the DVDs out with this product you've already made, and you're just paying 75 cents for a fucking DVD, and you're making money hand over fist there, and then eventually it would go live on Netflix, where you're getting, you know, that $1 billion royalty check for all your catalogs that you're sublicensing out through it. So this movie, again, it bombed in theaters. I loved it. I was working there. This thing got bounced out of the theater in a fucking hurry. This movie bombed because, and this is crazy, that's Titanic's fault. Titanic, another Paramount, was, and Paramount's important. Star Trek podcast is important because this is ultimately going to come down to Tuvok, right?
Mm-hmm, of course.
Titanic's running longer than it should. Paramount's panicking, and they say, we need to get something out to fill this gap in our theatrical releases. Your movie needs to come out now. And they preview it, and the story is funny because he's like, there's all this like insert stuff that they stopped watching the dailies. They knew there was a lot of material that was insert stuff, and they must have thought it was like close-ups of hands like pushing buttons and like B-unit stuff. And in fact, it's like my torture porn pre-Saw masturbatory piece. And the business execs, the suits watched it, and they were like, no fucking way. We're not going to have someone being held down while someone else drills screws into someone's teeth.
Holy literally. Shit.
Oh, did you God. Not read that?
I just only know it was all lost and that it was extensive. I don't need someone to describe it to me.
Too bad.
I guess I'm about to, though, for proceed.
But they're like, all right, cut the whore down big time. Also, the runtime's way too long. And as Anderson will come to say, he cut about 10 minutes too much off of it. It was edited back together poorly. They all felt, but this thing was rushed out to fill a gap that Titanic was creating. It flopped in exactly what you said. It got out, word of mouth spread it. DVD sales blew this thing up. They said, oh, wait, hold on a second. As is often the case, we see we now have a cash cow. Let's get that director's cut. Let's get that, you know, seven different releases out there. Moops. I don't know where all the stuff. There's perhaps one VHS of this thing in its entirety that the producer has. We've never watched it. And even if we did watch it, it's probably too fucked up to ever see the light of day.
It's a shame. I would agree that there was a lot of space that looks like some things got cut out that could have standard to have some more, you know, content. But overall, I think the tight runtime works for it. You don't do any dicking around in this movie, right? Like, it's either building very necessary backstory or executing on the premise. So I'm down for some brevity. I'm not against it. And an element, once that they have established the what's going on here, that starts immediately in that conversation and continues through, is I do think the crew knows this is the USS Hell Train very early on. And really what you're watching is them person by person starting to have to confront that reality in their own individual ways. Like, immediately the pilot's like, This is bonkers. This is obviously a curse. This has the gypsy curse. We must stay away from it at all costs. And then slowly every other crew member gets hit with the revelation of like, boy, this sure does look like an eldritch horror, doesn't it? Like, this definitely seems like a place where someone lost a lot of sand score. Like, Cthulhu is in here.
initially the script called for Event Horizon to be a luxury liner that went through another dimension or another part of space and came back with tentacle aliens. And it was going to be like a creepy alien movie. And it was Paul Anderson that said, well, you know what? That's a little too aliens. What if we go with the idea of a haunted house in space and we can play to all the haunted house tropes, but in space, and then we'll throw in a clear supernatural element instead of just space monsters. So they fly out to this thing. They get out of their gravity couches. Again, classic aliens, you know, people are smoking, have a good time, jawing around. I brought up the crew not wanting to be here as a great in-character mechanic for the anti-Promethean effect that happens here, right? Because mm-hmm. You watch Prometheus, and one of my many gripes about Prometheus is that Peter Whalen, who is rich as shit and one of the most important, if not the most important people on Earth, is trying to cheat death, and he finds this alien fucking thing and he's going to become immortal with it. And they scoop this fucking ragtag crew together of personality conflicts up and down the fucking walls. You can go into suspended animation. You got all the time in the world. You can't get these guys together to have coffee and figure out you've got like the fucking Suicide Squad, right?
get a better crew together. Get like a bunch of people are going to make correct decisions before you bet at all, you know?
Them rushing everybody out there and not really giving Miller a chance to talk. And like a lot of the behavior and rushed feeling of this becomes perfectly explained by the fact that people just want to get home. The Peters, you know, she wants to visit her sick son. Like a lot of the horror tropiness of people making silly decisions or just lack of communication and stuff works because these are guys that have been burning the candle at both ends and they want to go. So they fly up on the ship. And immediately they do the classic horror movie thing where they all split up.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. They do a really cool boarding sequence to get their suits on. Again, it's like giving you context for how analog the universe is. And the captain and the lieutenant are going to go towards the bridge while the poor Ensign Jabroni has to go into the back where the engine is. And
Weir has to stay on the bridge and he's pissed.
Yeah, he's like, no, I need to be there. And it's where you get your first taste of Captain Miller being like, no, you're going to do exactly what I say. I am in charge. I need you here. And he's good at leading people to where he wants them to be. Right. He like says no. And then softly like, I need you here. Like, I still need you. I need to participate. It's important. Soothe his ego. Poor Ensign Justin. Right. Ensign Jabroni Justin, he draws the ultimate horror movie short straw in that he is sent off alone first. And as we mentioned already, he goes through the ship and reaches where the engineering section is. And the movie doesn't hide from the audience that this is fucked up. We've got this weird chamber. It seems like a meat grinder, but Weir's got an explanation for it. And he goes into the main engine chamber and you look at it and it just clearly looks like a bunch of eldritch symbols everywhere. But then when the camera gets close, it almost looks hyper technologic. And then when we see behind the scenes later, it does appear to again be so like advanced in technology that is it that, or is it technology hiding as eldritch? Is there something that Weir tapped into or was given that he made this or was inspired to make it that came from a negative source, maybe a source within the Hell Dimension itself? All of these kind of questions entered the chat as you see your poor Jabroni character walk into what's going to obviously get him killed. And it's the danger is off the charts.
Everybody's kind of walking in their own shitty situation at about the same time. Real quick, the magnetic containment device that they use to separate the engineering from the people part, which is a catwalk with a cylinder that is rifled. So there's like a twisting swirl pattern with squares and light behind it. So it's like lit up squares spinning. Have you ever walked through one of those at a haunted house?
Yeah, I have.
It's a crazy op. It's not an optical illusion. It's a crazy physiological effect. When you walk through that, you instantly lurch hard to whatever direction the thing's rotating in.
It's like fucking with your equilibrium or something.
Oh, it's awful. And I'm reading, like, at the end when Lawrence Fishburne's trying to run out of there, like, it took him like three different takes because, like, he's fallen over and he couldn't do it. Like, you have to basically close your eyes to walk through this thing. So you got Justin in the engineering area. You've got whatever lady up on the fucking bridge. And it's like the classic, like, no, don't go in there. She's exploring and she somehow misses the fucking portals and the side viewports that are just caked in skull and human sludge.
She keeps looking away as they get illuminated by Neptunian lightning. Like classic, like, huh? Well,
you just sign her right up for Mystery Incorporated. Like, she is very oblivious. She's trying to rip a fucking DVD out of the DVD slot, which is the, you know, the ship's manifest or crew log, when the only body left over, which is this all cut up fucking icy cadaver, bumps into her and like she shits herself. You've got, I think Miller like went to the other big set area, which is the infirmary. He gets spooked.
Yeah, by and, a hand, disembodied hand.
Well, no, it's just a glove.
Oh, was it a glove? Okay.
Yeah, and then the rest of the time, you've got the rest of the crew. Again, very aliens watching the video feeds off of everybody else and providing color commentary. They see the dead body. They go, oh, something's wrong. Meanwhile, they lose contact with Justin down in the engineering section. And this is where the... So the main engine is three rings spinning. It looks like, you know, some little thing you'd have on your desk that's like perpetual motion or whatever. And then there's a big cylinder in the middle, and this thing looks like a lament configuration cube from Hellraiser.
Absolutely.
Spiky fucking Iron Maiden shit all around. God,
I feel like be completely uninitiated into this, and you would walk into the room and be like, this is evil. Whatever this is, don't build this. Never build a spiky death chamber engine. It's going to go to hell. It's the only place it can go.
I'm going to say if there's any major miss in this movie, it's the fact that nobody gets impaled on any of these, especially when you have some lady fall from the ceiling later on that she fell and hit a catwalk instead of getting impaled on the fucking wall here.
It's a missed opportunity.
It's a massive miss.
Yeah.
And I think God, if only someone had been impaled on this, because like you're in a spaceship that loses gravity. Like you've got a wall designed to stab and fuck people up. Like this is an OSHA violation award that not even the fucking the Zindi could touch with their lack of railings.
This room is the singularity of every OSHA violation.
You know, the engine, the rings align, the metal parts retract, and then you have this wall of black. It's like evil Stargate, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just this thick, inky darkness goop. And then Justin's looking at it, and there's like hypnotic lights flashing, and he puts his hand into the fucking goop, which seems like stupid horror movie shit, right? Like, why would you fucking touch that, dude? Like, who knows what radioactive... You're touching ship engine. You know it's a ship engine. You're engineered. You don't go into the fucking... Start grabbing uranium, right? Cut scene was him discussing about how he loves this ship. He's obsessed over it, and he is very interested in it. And, like, this is curiosity killing the cat, basically. Like,
oh, that does flesh out why he would touch it. Like, yes. If he had added in a pre-existing obsession with the ship and its lore.
It sucks him in. They lose contact. Cooper jumps in to rescue him, goes in, observes the engine in this open configuration. In the process, when he comes out, it blows out a shock ring. It fucks the Lewis and Clark up real bad. Fucks all the shit up in the event horizon. They pull him out. Justin's in a coma. and they're describing what happened to him, and Weir starts downplaying things. You're seeing things. It could not have possibly been what you've seen, because that would mean that the engine core was exposed, which means that it would have been active. You know, there's no way the ship could have done this itself. And all the bells are ringing now that something is afoot. Things are very wrong, and Weir's steadfast denial as to what's happening shows us that Weir is not going to be a good guy moving forward.
They do a good job of making you feel like Weir is going to be the protagonist at the beginning, and then that allows you to have sympathy for him, which they return to near the end. And yet he is the bad guy. It's a nice, complex way to like play the story out. Like, he's not the black hat through the whole thing. Like, at the beginning, you think like he's tortured. He's the good guy. He's on a mission, something to do with his wife, maybe. He's Alan Grant.
He saves kids from raptors. This dude's a hero. And maybe that's why he took the role, too, is like, you know, I've got too much good guy credit. I need to get some dirt under my fingernails. I need 7 hours in makeup to be covered in fucking burns and cuts with my eyes scooped out.
I really started to love Captain Miller as a character, starting with the scene where, you know, he is trying to hash out with what Cooper's saying and what Weir is saying. He is approaching it from a very military leader standpoint. Clearly, things are fucked. This is a very weird situation they're in. It's very uncomfortable. So he cuts the crap and he's like, I know a thing happened. I have this circumstance. Dr. Weir, I need an explanation for this thing that has happened, right? Like, I have a real world consequence. I can observe the consequence. I can see the consequence. I need you to tell me what caused it, right? And it's a way to like cut the it provides tension into the scene in a way, because he's trying to cut through the crap. Weir's trying to disassemble the question. And he's not letting him do it. And it's because, in my opinion, upon having just recently rewatched it, Miller knows from the jump this is a hell ship. It's just, this is a process of him coming to terms with that. But from this scene forward, he's looking around this bridge. He sees the liquefied remains. He sees the body that was already here. He's hearing the story about the hell dimension. This place just feels like absolute fuck. Yeah, this is the ship of the damned.
Miller, as a captain and as a hero, might be one of the strongest examples of a perfect good guy that I think I may have ever seen in any recent media. I think it's awesome they got Lawrence Fishburne and that it's a black dude portraying him. And that there's nothing about him that comes off as like corny or Mary Sue-ish.
It's perfect. It's a perfect performance on his part. I agree.
I mean, at the end, he's completely selfless. The dude's carrying baggage that impacts his decision making. The only mistake he makes is not identifying Weir as a bad actor and disclosing prematurely and almost vindictively, I'm going to blow this motherfucker up, which I think it's fair for him not to be aware of the exact extent of Weir's madness and the level of supernatural shit that's going to happen. Like, if you're a dude and you're like, all right, if Weir gets too squirrel, I can just blast him in the mouth, knock him out and be done with him. Like, you wouldn't be expecting him to turn into some fucking Resident Evil creature.
Right. Like, okay, well, whatever. I'll just fucking leave you here is what he was saying. Like, fuck you.
Right. But a lot of times you get the hero character in a horror movie and it's kind of eye rolly or whatever. Like, this dude holds down the fort across the board, just a strong character with a strong actor portrayal, and the whole thing comes out as great. What will proceed from this point forward is a series of perhaps hallucinations, perhaps real events, where everybody's prior tragedies and problems are brought up and dangled in their face. The one lady sees her child and his legs are all fucked up. There was a maggot scene apparently with that they had to cut because it was too graphic. They also cut a scene where Dr. Lorca, Jason Isaacs, DJ, we find out that as a child, he was very sick and had to go under several operations where he almost died. And he's like, has this irrational fear of dying on the operating table, which is, of course, how he dies. A couple people get off noticeably easy. Smith on the ship, right after they fix the Lewis and Clark, they're like, yay, we can leave. Everything's great now. Weir goes full nuts. Event Horizon, the front is where the humans are. The back is where the engine is. There's a long bridge that connects it. which you do the reasonable thing and have like, you know, 60 pieces of C4 ready to blow that motherfucker up. So like, it's kind of like Galaxy class. You can leave the engine behind while the front axe is a lifeboat. Weir steals one of those C4s, goes over to the Lewis and Clark and blows the fucking thing up right when it's ready.
Perfect ending for Smitty because he loves that ship. He's its pilot. It's his job, right? Like he was fixing it the whole movie. And so he refuses to leave. He's going to save the ship. You know, he's told, get it back on the Event Horizon. He's like, no, fuck that. I'm not getting on the hell ship.
He loves the ship and he hates Event Horizon. And that's another thing. Like Smith knows immediately that ship is bad news.
He's absolutely the first crew member who
this is the dude with like, mention it. This is the dude with like, you know, crosses and stuff. And you can tell he's superstitious / religious. And it's like, I'm not going to be, I will stay in the spacesuit outside fixing the hull. I'll do whatever I can not to go on Event Horizon. So he gets the, probably the best death in terms of humanity where he just simply gets blown up. There's a C4 brick in his face. He pulls the thing down, finds it finally. Oh, there's 5 seconds. Ah, fuck. Cooper should have gotten the real shitty death. Well, it's a horror movie. So being flung into the far reaches of space to die alone in the dark while your air runs out is actually pretty preferable to a lot of other people's deaths in this thing.
But of course they do. They turn him into the big trope break in the movie in that he's able to affect at a return back to the ship using his spacesuit in an inventive way. He gets off pretty light on the visions, and so does Stark. Stark doesn't really have one either. It's just like the knocking at one point, like when it's like the force is trying to escape is really the only time that she's affected by it.
That's not really a vision though, because that door is permanently dented for the rest.
She doesn't have like the personal horror thing right. that happens to everybody else. Same with Jones, rather Cooper. And so when these personal horror things happen, it's, you know, it's the process by which now it does the basic thing, which is you get to know the character's fears. And that's clearly like what the film is trying to inform you on. It's like, these are visions from their pasts. The ship is preying on it in some way. It has a real like psychic manifestation that's negative, but also is the window through which each character, like DJ is very, you know, logical. So is the captain. And they are the ones where they take the longest time to really like settle on, this is supernatural in nature. This went to a place that we would call hell. And we have increasing evidence of that. And of course the biggest piece is that they have the log from the ship, which they pick up close to the beginning there and then start to try and decode it. It starts out all Star Trek-y and then there's horror. And it isn't until close to the end of the movie that it's decoded. And there's this great scene where Miller and DJ are called up to the bridge to see the recording. And it's just it's the one piece of the torture porn that survived that's actually in the film. And they watch it. And then Miller stops it and just says, "We're leaving. Like, there will be no further conversation. I am not going to have a conversation. We all know what is happening.
We all just watched a guy get fucked in the ass by a pipe while another guy is raping some lady while eating her boobs in cannibalism. And the captain has clawed his own eyes out." So let me dip into this torture porn world here, right?
Right.
This is stuff that was shot as basically insert material, so the execs didn't see it.
Right.
Some guy named Vadim something was responsible for the filming a lot of this stuff. He might need to be arrested. All right. There's a scene that was cut where a man is crawling away as other people beat his legs with pipes until the legs are like completely smashed and it's just stumps crawling away. They got a bunch of someone else gets an arm ripped off. So they got amputees to play those people. So it was like extra creepy. Fuck it up. They got porn performers for all the rape scenes. Cannibalism scenes.
Got to get professionals. That's good.
I already talked about the screws getting put in. So this scene goes on for like a couple minutes. And I think if there's anything to lose, that's probably the good stuff where it's better, like the stuff of legends rather than the things that actually pop up in the movie.
I don't need to see any more than what I saw, right? What you see is just enough to make it very clear what's happened here. And it is interesting to see that the screenwriter acknowledged the Warhammer 40K connection.
Absolutely.
And this is very much in lore with 40K of what happens if you're a human and you're exposed to the warp, that the corrupting influence of the warp immediately takes you over. And this is the shit you can expect, like this exactly. So the fact that that was not a coincidence, now that I'm seeing this, boy, okay, cool. Like that connection that people drew was for a good reason.
Let's go to the other sci-fi connections here, right? Having just watched this, I kind of want to go back and watch Random Thoughts, which is the...
Oh, yeah, that's the Voyager episode that has some of this footage in it.
I think there's more footage in Voyager than there was in this. Like,
oh, no. It was much faster. It was faster,
but I don't think it's limited to just what we saw here. It might have been, like, other shit. And what we're talking about, of course, is Random Thoughts, where we find out that Tuvok's got some serious emotional baggage and this planet where they trade dark secrets and impulses and dirty thoughts as a forbidden commodity. Tuvok's just carrying around this hell footage in his mind to give people. What a value add that must be for their society. But yeah, they literally just use Event Horizon hell footage on that. There is a central theme that comes up on at least three characters, right? Weir's girlfriend, Weir, and the former captain of the Event Horizon, Kilpatrick. This deal with clawing their own eyes out, which is not a great special effect, I'll say. Like, looking at the way that they have shown the eyes as empty sockets, like, it makes their eyes look red more than it looks like hollow sockets. I don't know what the right way to have done that would be, but it's very disturbing to all of the people who see it. When after Weir has gone off the fucking deep end and he claws his own eyes out, Miller's like, why did you claw your eyes out? And Weir's like, well, we're going, you don't need eyes. But like, can you think of any deeper metaphor or anything poetic as to why the absence of the eyes are, it comes up three different characters? Or is that
question,
the badge
actually,
of hell?
Like, it is really horrific for humans because the eye and sight is so fundamental to the human experience. So maybe that's a way you convey the incredible alienness of this other dimension, that it's a place where your sight is unnecessary because the sensory overload that comes with the horror, you can't beat even if you can't see it. Right. Because that is how you hide from a lot. That's how you know, when you see something scary, you don't look at it. Right. Like, oh, you can rip out your eyes. It doesn't matter.
Mm.
You know, maybe
I like
that's
that
what they're
answer.
Going for.
Yeah. You cannot hide from this. You can't close your eyes. You can rip your fucking eyes out. You're still going to see it. I guess the hard part of that, or at least dropping that eyeless thing, and obviously it's a visual effects cost because now you have to CG the eyes out. But like at the end, when Miller comes back regenerated as like final form evil guy, he does have his eyes back, and it's like the only part of his body that's not mutilated.
Yeah, it was weird. Yeah, Weir's final boss form has his eyes. It is actually cooler, I think, the way he comes back with just all the scars.
Yeah. So that's, and I forgot that even happened. Like, Weir claws his eyes out. We have the birth of an entire sci-fi franchise in this moment where Weir has now blown up the Lewis and Clark. Miller's like, okay, you're a bad guy and I'm going to need to kill you. And I'm going to go to this closet where you have hull repair stuff. And I'm going to get one of these bolt guns out, which we just saw being used to fix the Lewis and Clark. And it's like a street sweeper that shoots spikes, right? Hello, my name is Dead Space. Would you like to make a video game about me? We're going to use mining equipment to fight monsters.
And it's great. It's a great thought, right? Why would they have guns? I mean, no reason to have a gun in this circumstance.
And why wouldn't you make a piece of industrial hardware not closely resemble a gun? Which, it's a nail gun. You know, that's this. Yeah, this is space Quake, nail baby. Gun. It's yeah. Quake. That's all. Weir will eventually be sucked out into space and die, and then the ship regenerates him in a bloodbath, which I completely forgot about that, and that was fucking cool.
The pacing of the ship's overt supernatural abilities is well handled, that it kind of crescendos into that, right? Like, we're clearly through the looking glass. It's not just fucking within the rules. It is now obliterating the rules. Like, this thing can, in fact, just resurrect people that you just watched die. And in its dark, horrific glory. And it's a nice way to sort of cap off the tension. At this point, the only survivors...
And also, real quick, it doesn't reach absolute bonkers until Miller openly says, we're going to get off this ship, and I'm going to blow this motherfucker up.
Yeah, which is his commitment to, like, I am not leaving it here. I have a duty to destroy the hell ship, because I'm hero. I'm
going to nuke it from orbit, because it's the only way to make sure.
Yeah,
and then the ship's like, by the way, I'm alive, I can hear you. I'm going to take your little buddy Weir over, puppeting this marionette of a fantasy wife he has. You mentioned it already. I want to talk real quick. At one point, Weir has to go try and fix something that's fucking up, and he effectively goes into Jeffrey's tubes, which is behind this like H.R. Geiger torture wall in the engine. And the Jeffrey's tubes are like lit up plastic circuit boards, which will become intense strobe lights for some real creepy alone in the dark light play / jump scares with his eyeless wife. Like, that's really his descent into madness.
That at that point, he's still hanging on to some of his wherewithal because he was calling for Miller's help.
Yes.
He knew it was fake. After that is when he seems to make the hard turn to decide, like, oh, I can somehow reach my wife through this. And you find out, because basically everyone dies by this, by the point that he's pulling his eyes out, right? Like, you had Peters died by falling, chasing a specter version of her son.
OSHA death.
Clear OSHA death.
I want to see the scene where, like, the ship becomes evil and, like, sentience warms over it, and it, like, does a little shimmy, and every single railing and handhold and safety device just falls.
Actual OSHA death, and they just all fail at the same time.
All the railings, pitfalls open up, and this thing just becomes the most dangerous place to work. And, like, prior to that, it was, like, you know, nice hand, good railings, maybe even, like, nets and stuff to catch people.
Justin got decompressed but lived, which is actually probably my quote death of the movie, because it was definitely the most horrific. There was from the, like, all the tension and, like, oh, something real bad's gonna happen, and he's suffering, and he goes through the decompression sickness, and like all of his blood vessels start to burst, and he's like just an absolute mess.
Joe, what if I told you that's more Expanse just waiting for you?
Oh,
there's a lot of Expanse in this. I'm sorry, there's a lot of Event Horizon in the Expanse.
Makes a lot of sense, though. If you're going to do a realistic sci-fi universe, yes, this is a great cinematic representation. So there's so much you can use.
Justin's to do important because things are relatively normal at this point. He has been in a coma. He wakes up after being abused in hell, and he is in this, like, safe mode where
catatonic. Yeah.
A deeper part of him is acting and saying, I've seen what happens, and trust me when I tell you, being blown out into space, this is very somber the way he delivers, but, like, we're all going to die. This is terrible. And please just let me die in space so I don't have to go back to hell.
Yeah. Like, it's better if we just die and not go back.
But then,
like,
he snaps out of it, and, like, his, was it id and ego? Is that ego then comes back? He's like, no, what are you guys doing? Open the door. And they're like, dude, you did this to yourself. You opened the door. What did Red Letter Media say? I don't get how this is a bad movie to them. No, sitting here talking about this with you, like, it's become even better in my mind.
I would have to go back to watch. They were very cold on it, and I was kind of surprised by that. And I guess because I love this movie, I started to check out of what they were saying. I tried to give it a shot because I wanted to hear a contrary opinion, but they seemed to overly focus on, like, it's edited poorly and the CG's bad. Like,
CG's not that bad. Like, it's 97, and you're trying to do something incredibly, like, the most prevalent CGI in this is, again, free-floating globs of grease. I've never seen a free-floating glob of grease. I can't tell you what it would look like in real life.
And I also think they don't like Paul W.S. Anderson because they kind of blew up as a consequence of them doing what you talked about, which is watching all of the Resident Evil movies and driving themselves to madness. And that left them with a bad taste in their mouth, I think, in a way. But might have to revisit that after this. But anyway, movie has progressed. Most of the crew is dead. You have leftover Cooper, who has survived his ordeals in his suit, much to the audience's astonishment. You have Stark, who has definitely gotten her ass kicked, but
takes an Archer level amount of head wounds.
Yeah,
she falls down ladders. She gets thrown into walls. She gets kicked and hit. She gets dumped and, you know, dunked in blood and then thrown down a ladder again. Like, this lady.
But she gets rescued from certain death by none other than Captain Miller, who, of course, that's probably his big character moment, which is he redeems himself. And the only one he really gets to redeem himself from his vision of the guy he left behind is his vision. The guy he let die in a rescue ship that, you know, he didn't have the opportunity to save and had to watch him suffer as he was buffeted by flames. And rather than abandon Stark, he stays in the breach and says, "I am not leaving without you," and manages to save her at the last second, which is just a great way to tie up, like, okay, well, he's fulfilled his purpose. That means he's definitely going to die a heroic death in this film. Like, he's got permission now. Like, so he gets Cooper and Stark into position to use the front half of the Event Horizon as a lifeboat and says, "I'm going to go back and blow this thing up and we're going to get the fuck out of here," which of course is exactly when resurrected Weir shows up. They have a giant showdown.
You call him Cenobite Weir.
Yeah,
right?
He's got superpowers, by the way. He has super strength, which is why he was able to immediately punk DJ the Doctor.
I want to talk about that real quick. So, yeah. No, he's not Cenobite Weir at that point. He's still just...
He's partial Cenobite Weir, because he was throwing him around. Weir. He was throwing him around with one hand like it was nothing then.
Right. He also has super speed, because at this point, Miller's occupied... This is jumping back scenes and scenes, but this was a big point for me. Miller's dealing with the explosion of the Clark. He goes to tell DJ, "Hey, Weir is a bad guy. You see him, you take him out." DJ, who, despite you saying he's logical, this dude is a serial killer waiting to happen. At one point, he has Alfred Pennyworth at knife point, at scalpel point, trying to get him to, quote unquote, chill out. Anyways, he's got the saw. He turns around ready to, like, you know, go to war. Oh, yeah, Weir standing right behind him, knocks him over. Weir puts him on the gurney, vivisects him. And, like, however long it takes for Miller to run from the airlock to the infirmary, Weir has time to not only pull out all of DJ's organs and align them anatomically correct on the table, but also suspend his body from the ceiling with hooks and wires, and also to sew his own eyelids shut after he had scooped his eyes out in the engineering area.
He used all his hell celerity to, like, book all that, like... His hell energy is low.
He used his hell temporis as some tempest fugit there. Even to the point, right before he rips his own eyes out, he sees Peters laying there dead, and he mourns her passing. So, like,
it's like his last shred of humanity departing was seeing Peters being dead.
Yeah, because
Peters was nice to him during the mission.
Yeah, he's like, "Oh damn, Peters, you died, and you didn't even get to die being impaled on this fucking spiky evil." That's the engineering area is like evil Epcot Center. That's the best way to visualize it.
Yeah, yeah, agreed. It's a very inside out evil Epcot Center.
So Miller goes back to arm the demolition hallway to separate the engine, because at this point, and Weir has engaged the warp drive, and is his plan, and this is calculated on his end, is that he doesn't want to kill anybody else. He wants to bring fresh souls back to hell to, you know, for the devil to rip up or whatever the fuck.
Because Weir is convinced, his character motivation is he has become convinced that, because we find out his wife committed suicide from neglect from him, right? Like, we finally see that close to the end of the film, is he is driven to reclaim the Event Horizon because he literally sacrificed his relationship and therefore the life of his wife to its creation over the course of 14 years. And its disappearance has haunted him, and he sees it as a vessel to return to his wife. And then literally the ship is trying to tell him, oh, your wife is in, you know, in hell, and you just need to join. You need to come and you can see her and be with her. Of course, it's the ship fucking with him, most certainly, rather than an actual proclamation of the destination of his wife's soul. It had nothing to do with the project, but that tightens up nicely at the end, where it's fully brought him into his grasp. His shields are down, you know, he's in her embrace, and from that point forward, he's made the heel turn.
I would argue at the point where he gets regenerated in the Bacca tank in blood, that's not really Weir anymore, and that's actually the ship using his form. There's deleted scenes where, like, the dude basically admits he's the devil.
That makes sense, too.
And again, it's, you know, it's a Star Trek thing. Like, throw out the line of technobabble where we say that there's the atmosphere is ionized and we can't use the transporters as the common sense solution to fix the plot here, right? Why is Cenobite Weir beating the shit out of Miller and not just killing Miller in this fucking Terminator? It's like Terminator always throws people instead of just ripping heads off, because he wants the soul to bring back into hell. So we get a protracted fight sequence there. Miller made the mistake, instead of just blowing, because of course the arming fucking thing for the C4 charges is like right in front of engineering. As he's putting the final system to arm, the fiery man of the crew member he lost appears and like throws a fireball, and he has to like run down the meat grinder hallway and jump in and trap himself in battle arena to Shinden for the final fight. I'll tell you what, man, fucking the engineering room in Event Horizon would be a great Mortal Kombat level.
It would. Maybe that was where he took some of his inspiration.
Could kick people. Oh, yeah. Hey, that's Mortal. You could kick people right into hell, literally.
I do like, though, that ultimately, like, what a fucking absolute Chad-like maneuver on Miller's part, that he's like, I'm going to blow the bridge and I'm going to hell. Right? Like, I can't escape being stuck with this asshole. I can't overpower him.
Take me, let the others go. And then Miller's like, no, I'm getting everybody. You get your second visions of hell here. And this is where Cenobite Weir / the devil gives Miller visions of the remaining crew members who are still alive in like barbed wire torture seats, like,
oh, it was some of the dead ones too, by the way, if you look through it. Yeah,
well, that's not good for those guys. So this is like a Voyager. There's just space demons out there, and if you die, you get sucked into the hell realm, and too bad, everybody who dies goes to hell. That's where Miller really sees what the stakes are on this thing. Whatever I said before, Miller's big mistake was admitting he was going to blow the ship up. Miller's second big mistake was not just hitting the fucking plunger on the bridge there so he could blow himself up instead of getting sucked off to hell. But if you're saying that's what happens anyways.
Yeah, I mean, I think it adds so much to like the nature of how exactly perfectly heroic he is. Like you said, this dude is such an absolute unit that he's like, I can't beat this guy. I only hope is to blow the bridge, save my last two remaining crew members, and then just take the hell ride with this guy and whatever. Like, that sucks, but I'm going to hang the biggest W I can on this situation and do right by my people who are still alive and don't have to get sucked into hell. What a fucking, true Starfleet heroism right there in the Warhammer universe, you know?
Yep.
Like, doing the right thing.
The last good guy. The movie ends with a new rescue ship finding the floating bridge section. We get another aliens-esque, you know, moving in, checking the carnage, finding the bodies. They let Stark out of her gravity couch. She's freaking out. You get the jump scare as you see the rescue guy open his helmet up. It's cut up weird. It's Cenobite weird. Oh my God. Oh no. You know, it's impulse ending, right? No, it was just a hallucination. One last jump scare before off we go.
Something else Stevie said is like, well, clearly that front half of the ship was also in hell. It has the hell presence. And like you said, if Weir is a manifestation of the ship, like, is it? Like, what's going on? Like,
I would say
this movie's not over.
That is a legit observation. It's one I had as well. However, Weir does explicitly say that the warp drive is the heart of the vessel. And I would say that Miller did get a solid win. He blew the heart up.
Right.
The rest of the ship is then cut off from the source of hell and should be in her. Clearly, she's got baggage she's bringing forward emotionally and psychologically, but.
And head woundsy. You know, just got so much CTE now.
Yep. And then we, you know, cut out to Prodigy Techno ending. And I think it's extremely fitting for it. Interesting stuff happens later on. There was talk starting in 2019 or maybe 2020. Right, kind of like when it seemed like streaming had infinite budget and everything was becoming a miniseries. There was talk about making an Event Horizon TV show, which I think is a fucking terrible idea, especially when The Mist bombed as hard as it did. There's a couple interviews with Paul Anderson where they talk about like potentially doing a second movie or a prequel. And I forget what the line of the quote is, but basically like, I don't want to do anything else with Event Horizon because all it's going to do is drag down what I already made and
right.
Do no good of it. So this is like the studio and stuff, but all that stuff seems like it's paused. And with all the streaming cuts, I'm sure this got fucking scrapped. Did you see the Kurt Russell quote?
No.
Kurt Russell apparently is an oracle of sorts. Basically, while filming Soldier, this thing was out and bombing hard in the theaters. And Kurt Russell's like, listen, man, ignore what's happening right now. Trust me, in 20 years, this thing's going to be a fucking mega hit. And you're going to be mad that this is you're going to be glad that this is what you made. And
wow.
Yeah.
Talk about bro-ing someone up and being absolutely correct. Like, it had to be weird for him to put this out, for it to bomb in the box office, and then probably be his critically best received film of his whole career. Like, this is a movie people genuinely love, and not in some like ironic way, like Mortal Kombat, which is objectively not a good movie, but is fun to watch.
Yeah.
This is just good. This, everything about this works. He directs his actors well. He's acting purely as a director, which he does rarely in his career. He wrote most of his films. I don't think that was necessarily the right call for him, because if he gets to just focus on the craft of directing, clearly he's got a lot to offer. And I think it's a shame that this didn't get a chance to at least get a director's cut, right? Like, I think you're right. A TV series, I don't think is necessary here.
No.
As much as I said, like the universe demands more detail because it's so well realized. That could be an extra 20 minutes. That could be an extra 25 minutes added to this to just add all of the pieces that really do feel like they're missing.
And of course, that's not financially feasible, but you're absolutely right. If they could go in and give me that boardroom, give Weir talking about the science, flesh out Weir was getting past notes from hell of, hey, look, here's a book that just so happened to end up in a library you're at. And it's
some kind of background on if technology and the occult had somehow mixed in some fashion. Mm-hmm. And Weir was like a patsy for that.
Because you're also getting like heavy UAC doom, right?
Absolutely.
Like, there's a lot of video game.
Doom was already its own thing, but like later versions of Doom. What was the Doom? The one when you needed a flashlight.
Doom 3.
Was that Doom 3?
It was.
That's the one where they really like cement, like there was a corporate culture of infernalism.
At UAC, yeah.
At UAC, and them willfully engaging in supernatural shit to achieve this teleportation technology. I don't know if they ever cite this stuff as source material, but great movie. I like horror. I like sci-fi. I've always liked Event Horizon. Am I going back and viewing this thing again? Even better than I remember. And I absolutely encourage you to go read the Wikipedia, because it is a cornucopia of deleted scene information and cool background. Also, IMDb trivia section has a lot of stuff that's not in Event Horizon either. And I think I'm going to try and like sit down and watch some YouTube videos or something and see if they ever did do any sort of behind the scenes on this, because it's just fucking awesome. And I love
it. There was a lot of like discussion from Paul W.S. Anderson, and apparently this movie has amazing commentary track as well. Yeah, there wasn't, I don't think, any behind the scenes. Like, they lost everything. The only cut of this movie is the theatrical cut, and there's really not much else. There's one deleted scene that they had in partial, without effects, that is just a kind of a extended background scene of Weir meeting with like the Admiralty to go on the mission that really isn't necessary. Like, that scene getting cut made sense.
I'll watch it anyways. Fuck it, man.
Well, this was worthwhile, man. I enjoyed this. I would revisit. I love revisiting this movie. It's a great Halloween banger. And if you somehow have missed it, do yourself a favor and watch Event Horizon.
It's so different than anything you see now. And it's interesting that this would come out and be viewed as bad in the theaters. And watching it now, it just feels refreshing and good.
Yeah. And I wonder if that, if you watched Into the Mouth of Madness.
No.
I recommend that for you. That is another Cthulhu mythos adaption in a way. It's like Cthulhu-esque. It's a Carpenter movie.
We can't go wrong with Carpenter.
Sam Neill in the lead. I would watch it.
I'll give that a shot. There's no crying in this movie. There's a lot of emotional baggage, and there's a lot of my dark tragic history, which, you know, we give Strange New World shit for.
But everyone keeps their shit together.
Yeah, everybody.
And it's because of the captain character who keeps them keeping their shit together.
Like no mushy emotional, like I'm crying. I don't know, man. Just it's very different than anything you'd see in 2020, 2018 forward. Neat time capsule. I love it.
And we love you here at VJ Please. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting us on Patreon, and we'll see you next time.